It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting a dangerous disease spreads. The World Health Organization says the Zika virus is spreading rapidly through the Americas and could affect as many as 4 million people. The virus has been seen as a possible cause of birth defects. The UN Health Agency's Director General, Margaret Chan, told a special meeting of the WHO in Geneva Thursday that the Zika virus is spreading.
Last year, the virus was detected in the Americas, where it is now spreading explosively. As of today, cases have been reported in 23 countries and territories in the region.
Chan has called for an emergency meeting of experts on Monday. Republican presidential candidates on Thursday are held their last debate before Monday's Iowa caucuses. Most of the candidates quickly addressed moderator Megyn Kelly's request to address the elephant not in the room, that the frontrunner, Donald Trump, was choosing not to participate in the debate. Texas Senator Ted Cruz lobbed a few fake insults to fellow candidates.
I'm a maniac, and everyone on this stage is stupid, fat, and ugly. And Ben, you're a terrible surgeon. Now that we've gotten the Donald Trump portion out of the way.
Senator Marco Rubio said that while Trump is entertaining, the campaign is not about Trump. Political leaders in Somalia have agreed on a framework for holding elections this year. The framework was announced Thursday after 2 days of talks in Mogadishu. It calls for the creation of an upper house of parliament with 54 seats allocated among Somalia's states. Seats in the lower house would be allocated using a power-sharing arrangement among the country's four major clans and their smaller counterparts. This is VOA News. U.S. President Barack Obama has directed his national security advisors to counter efforts by Islamic State to expand into Libya and other countries. The president emphasized that the United States will continue to counter IS plotters in any country where it is necessary. The Syrian opposition says it will not be at talks on the situation in Syria scheduled to begin in Geneva on Friday. The Saudi-backed group known as the High Negotiations Council said Thursday the responses they have received to their demands for an end to airstrikes and the lifting of a siege in Syria are not acceptable. The council did not rule out joining the talks later. Turkey's Security Council announced Thursday that Syrian Kurdish group PYD and its militia have no future in Syria. Turkey is warning it could intervene militarily, as we hear from Dorian Jones.
Turkey's National Security Council released a statement saying that along with the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian Kurdish group, the PYD, and its armed wing, the YPG, should play no role in Syria's future. Ankara accuses the PYD and YPG as offshoots of the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, which Turkish forces are currently battling both domestically and by air in Iraq. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan this month promised to eradicate the PKK from the region. Dorian Jones, Istanbul.
A U.S. Senate panel unanimously approved tougher sanctions against North Korea. The sanctions target the North's nuclear program, cyber activities, and violations of human rights. Thursday's voice vote by the Foreign Relations Committee came several weeks after North Korea claimed it tested a hydrogen bomb. Republican Senator Cory Gardner said the proposed measures build on legislation passed earlier by the House of Representatives.
Both the House and the Senate bill focus on mandatory sanctions, which is a dramatic change from the sanction regime that we have in place today. But it also goes a step further in cybersecurity policies, codifying executive orders, and making sure that we're focusing on human rights. Our bill also goes into sanctions and second-order sanctions on minerals that could be used to fund proliferation activities.
Senator Cory Gardner. Opposition groups in Zambia are accusing the police there of using the nation's Public Order Act to violate citizens' constitutional rights to free speech and assembly. A spokesman for the police says political groups must coordinate their activities with authorities to maintain peace and stability. The local Catholic Bishops' Conference is calling on police to be impartial and nonpartisan. French police have arrested a man who was carrying two handguns and ammunition at a hotel in the Disneyland Paris theme park. Authorities said the man's bag triggered metal detectors at the hotel. A woman believed to be traveling with him slipped away before she could be detained. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Friday, the 29th day of January, and here are some of the stories we are covering. On the eve of an African Union summit, Burundi has again said no to the deployment of African peacekeepers.
We are a government that is open for cooperation, but we have to make a principled cooperation. The matter isn't simply saying we want to deploy. But why do we have to deploy in the first place?
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. Meanwhile, Amnesty International says it has evidence of mass graves in Burundi's capital. Sierra Leone security is on high alert due to fears of a terrorist attack. And Zambian police deny accusations they are biased in favor of the ruling party.
When we join the police, we are recruited as Zambians that are ready to serve the interests of the country, not the interests of any particular political party.
Charity Chanda is the spokesperson for the Zambian police. Freedom House says world freedoms decline for the 10th year and North Africa is one of the worst regions. And water levels along the Niger River are decreasing. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. On the eve of an African Union summit, Burundi has again said it will not accept AU peacekeepers in the country. The 26th ordinary session of the African Union opens tomorrow, Saturday, in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Top on the agenda is the state of peace and security on the continent. On Thursday, Burundi's main opposition coalition, SINARE, urged the African Union and the international community to send an AU peacekeeping force. SINARE leader Leonard Nyangoma reportedly said a failure by the international community to support the Burundian people will lead to the resurgence of armed groups to fight against what he called the aggression of Pierre Nkurunziza. Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe said the AU cannot send troops to any member country without the approval of that country.
One thing is to request and to ask for the AU to send troops. Another thing is for the AU to operationalize that request. What we all know is that the AU is not going to send troops to a country which has not expressed its consent for sending the troops. That is the conclusion of the ministerial meeting of the East African Standby Force, which, as you recall, was supposed to provide troops to that Maprobu mission. Now, if that was the conclusion of the ministerial meeting, I doubt that the AU Peace and Security Council will do otherwise.
So what is your government taking to Addis Ababa for the meeting? What offer are you going to make to the African Union?
The same offer that we have always been making. We are a government that is open for cooperation, but we have to make a principled cooperation. The matter isn't simply saying we want to deploy, but why do we have to deploy in the first place? So we are going to tell the African Union Peace and Security Council how committed to peace and stability we are, what are the steps that we have already undertaken to restore peace and calm in the town and in Bujumbura, and all those protests that have been in some sort of unrest over the last few months. And then, of course, we are going to extend our hand to the AU in letting them understand that we have never opposed any sort of international presence in Bujumbura, in Burundi in general, i.e. the issue of the human rights monitors and military experts. As you know, a number of them are already on the ground. Now we need to sit down and work out the modalities for the deployment of additional numbers, which, again, we have to be subject to an agreement with our government regarding the mandate, the location, the modus operandi, and things of that nature.
Mr. Minister, one of the reasons that the opposition is insisting on having the African Union forces because they think that that can help to quell the violence that they say is being perpetrated by your security forces.
Yeah, but you see, again, I'm not the spokesman for the opposition. They can say whatever they like. That's the right of the opposition. But I can tell you one thing. The African Union is made up of member states. And the member states of the African Union have respect for other member states. And it has been demonstrated many times. And one of those is today, when the African Union member states have elected Burundi. I repeat, Burundi, as one of the 15 member states to be in the Peace and Security Council for the next 2 years. It is a demonstration that they recognize that in Burundi there is a legitimate government which has participated fully in peacekeeping in Africa and beyond and is delivering in that area.
I was just reading the release from Amnesty International quoting satellite images where they say video footage and witness accounts analyzed by Amnesty International strongly indicate that dozens of people killed by Burundian security forces in December were later buried in mass graves.
No, I'm not a specialist of satellite imaging, so I wouldn't like to make any comment on this one way or the other. I am not, unfortunately, a technology whiz. I really wouldn't like to make any comment on this issue.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. Amnesty International says it has evidence that dozens of people apparently killed by Burundian security forces in December last year were buried in mass graves in the capital, Bujumbura. Adote Akwe is managing director for government relations with Amnesty International USA. He says the evidence comes from satellite images, video footage, and witness accounts.
As the news reported, there was a major upsurge of violence towards the end of 2015, and we were all very concerned about the reports of the killings. And so Amnesty International had some of its researchers who were conducting evidence look into allegations of mass graves. And when we found that there were several potential sites, we decided to use satellite technology to try to pinpoint locations that might have been problematic to get to, and also to look at those locations to see how they had changed or their appearance had changed over the period of time before December and since. And what we found was that it appears that there were mass graves there, and that it appears that people who were killed by the Burundian security forces in December were buried in these graves, and that the authorities are now trying to cover up the graves in order to cover up the extent of the killings.
The footage show who killed the people, because the government of Burundi has said that the opposition have been armed and they also are carrying on violence. So how do we know who killed the people?
Well, the first thing I think that we would be saying to everyone is that independent experts need to have access to these sites. That's the most authoritative way. And that, of course, is dependent on the government of Burundi giving permission for independent experts to come in to investigate the sites and to do forensic analysis. But we looked at those sites based on interaction with people who were actually eyewitnesses. And these people were the ones who said that it was security forces linked with the Burundian government that shot and killed these people, and then later came and retrieved those bodies and refused to tell people where the bodies were being taken.
The African Union is meeting in Addis Ababa on Saturday. Leaders from Africa are meeting there. Burundi is probably going to feature heavily at that meeting. What would you like for the African leaders to do?
We would like to make to have the African Union very forcefully call for a resolution at this assembly, urging prompt, impartial, and independent investigations into the events of December 11th, and also call for unfettered access into all suspected mass grave sites. In other words, we need the AU Peace and Security Council to really come together and really push for access and for accountability, not only because of the families that need to find out what happened to their loved ones, but also to bring those responsible to account.
Adote Akwe is Managing Director for Government Relations with Amnesty International USA. You're speaking with me from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Friday, the 29th day of January. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Opposition and civil society groups have accused the Zambian police of bias and violation of the constitution after clamping on their rights to free speech and assembly as stipulated in the Bill of Rights. The group said the police often used the controversial Public Order Act to suppress their meetings and their planned demonstrations against unfavorable government policies. But Charity Chanda, spokesperson for the Zambian police, tells reporter Peter Clotty all groups that plan to protest must notify the police at least 7 days in advance.
We are engaging the stakeholders in these elections. This is starting from the leadership of these different political parties where we urge them to talk to their cadres so that they refrain from getting involved in political violence. We've also intensified on the need to sensitize the provisions of the Public Order Act. We are also ready to apprehend and take to court all the perpetrators of violence.
Some of these political parties have accused the police of violating the Constitution, which allows them freedom of expression, assembly, among other issues. How is the police reacting to this criticism?
Most of the people do not understand the provisions of the Public Order Act. This law is actually very good when well followed and observed. We have political parties that will not give the necessary notification period, but you'd find that at times they notify you 2 days before. And at least right now we've got other duties that we do.
Opposition parties accuse the police of being partisan and always catering to the needs or aspirations of the ruling Patriotic Party and their supporters. How do you resolve such concerns from the opposition?
Yes, we are alive to the fact that those concerns have come through. But to tell you the truth, as a police, we try to be as professional as possible. When we join the police, we are recruited as Zambians that are ready to serve the interests of the country, not the interests of any particular political party. And this is what people have to understand. It's unfortunate that they are lining up to certain parties, but as far as we are concerned, we are not partisan. We are government workers, we are civil servants, and our interest is to serve the lives of the people of Zambia as well as their property.
Will the police organize a stakeholders conference to engage all these political parties to cooperate with them or to allow them to express their opinion in the way of easing such tension between the police and all these parties in the run-up to the election?
Of course, that has already started. We agreed that they are free to hold their meetings as long as they follow the provisions of the Public Order Act. And as long as they maintain law and order when they are holding these processions.
Charity Chanda is the spokesperson for the Zambian police. She spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. Freedom House says world freedoms declined for the 10th year and that North Africa is one of the worst regions. The group said more aggressive tactics by authoritarian regimes and an upsurge in terrorist attacks and a global economic downturn have contributed to a disturbing decline in freedom worldwide. The group also said leaders in several countries moved to extend their terms in office during 2015, most prominently in Burundi, Bolivia, Ecuador, the Democratic Republic of Congo, the Republic of Congo, and Rwanda. Jennifer Dunham, Director of Research for Freedom of the Press and Freedom in the World at Freedom House, spoke with Salim Fikadu of VOA's Amharic Service about Africa.
The conclusion of the report globally was that this was the 10th consecutive year of decline in global freedom, which is a very concerning development. Interestingly, for sub-Saharan Africa, we did see both declines in certain countries, but also very encouraging improvements. For example, in Nigeria, where we saw a watershed election. Also in countries like Burkina Faso, where they recovered from the coup that ousted a longtime leader, and they moved on to hold relatively competitive and successful elections. So Africa's always been a case of extremes. We see large declines or very low-ranking countries, such as Eritrea and Somalia, which are part of the worst of the worst, and we also see some very encouraging gains at the same time. So I think that there is some reason to be optimistic for Africa if you look at the cases where we have seen improvements. Along with Nigeria and Burkina Faso, we've seen some improvements in places like Cote d'Ivoire or Liberia, where they are moving towards a more model where they adopt good governance, where they look towards adhering to a free press and allowing civil society to operate freely. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that it's not all dire for the African continent.
Even in these negative places, you raise a very good point about any kind of semblance takes a little bit longer, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at, you know, the it's been 5 years since the Arab Spring, and, you know, we have the big success story, which was Tunisia, which everyone talks about. But I think that the other countries are still wrestling with the changes that came after they ousted the dictators that had been in power for so long. So, you know, it's like democracy in the West or the United States wasn't built in 10 or 20 or 30 years. It took hundreds of years. I think that, you know, any type of moving forward toward a good governance in not just Africa, but any place in the world, it's always a progression. And that goes for the West as well.
Jennifer Dunham is Director of Research for Freedom of the Press and Freedom in the World at Freedom House. She spoke with Salim Fekadu of VOA's Amharic Service. Recent hotel attacks in Burkina Faso and Mali have prompted concerns across West Africa. Nina DeVries reports for VOA on Sierra Leone's increased vigilance.
Sierra Leone has stepped up security not only around hotels popular with foreigners, but also at the airport, at land borders, and on the waterways. Francis Angumba Kelly, the spokesperson for the Office of National Security, ONS, in Sierra Leone, says there has been no direct threat from any terrorist organization, but that the country is not taking any chances.
So as a precautionary measure, we think we should start stepping up our security efforts, because we've also come to realize that most times the nature of the attacks actually look at vulnerable, you know, countries and areas that are frequented by foreigners, especially Westerners.
This is not the first time the country has increased security due to other attacks on the continent. In 2013, when the Somali-based militant group Al-Shabaab attacked the Westgate Mall in Kenya, Sierra Leone took similar protective measures. The ONS also wants to develop anti-terrorism legislation. Kelly says Sierra Leone's security forces are working on that with the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, which is offering technical input. He also cautions against overreaction.
There's no cause for alarm. I'm seeing a lot of misconceptions, messaging going on the social media. We're talking, don't go to Radisson Blue, don't go to this place. When you go to the room, don't go to the lobby, lock yourself in the room. I mean, these are all panicking situations that will not help the situation at all.
Hotel manager Nuno Neves at the Radisson Blue in Freetown echoes the views of the ONS. It's all about prevention. He says the hotel has stepped up security with more guards on patrol and new metal detectors. The hotel will also be installing more security cameras. Neves realizes people may be concerned about coming to Sierra Leone, but he wants to reassure them the right precautions have been taken.
So as long as this country is open for business, we should make it possible that people come here to feel comfortable, safe.
He adds the business slowed down a bit after the major Ebola crisis was declared to have ended last November in the country. Many of the international organizations fighting the deadly virus, which killed almost 4,000 people in Sierra Leone, stayed at the Radisson Blue. Still, he says the hotel is managing. Neves adds that he is in touch with embassies and the president's office to exchange ideas on additional security measures. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Water levels along the Niger River have decreased by up to 50% in some areas since 1950, according to Wetlands International. The group's Niger River expert, Barker Kone, tells Ricky Shryak that climate changes such as decreased rainfall are threatening the existence of the Niger River and the people living along the waterways.
Since the 1950, the Niger River discharge has decreased about 50%. That's a lot.
The water levels?
Yes. There are many reasons. First, you know that the Niger River depends on the water, which is the rainfall in Guinea, in the upper Niger. And you could see since 1970, the rainfall has decreased about 20% in the upper Niger. That has contributed a lot to the decrease of the water level in the Niger River, mainly in Niamey. Besides the decrease of the rainfall, also you could see there are many dams which are built upstream Niamey. All these dams are located upstream Niamey, and because of the management of those dams, those have also a lot of impact on the water level in Niamey. And in addition to the decrease on the rainfall, the management of the dam, you should not forget about evaporation. You know that before the water reached Nyame, the water had to cross the Inner Niger Delta, which is a huge floodplain, more than 20,000 square kilometers. Also in the Niger River, the evaporation is very high. During good flooding year, evaporation of the water could reach 50%.
Do increasing temperatures mean increasing evaporation?
Exactly. And also the temperature in Sahel, as is increasing. We are expecting for the coming 40 years, the temperature might increase about 7 degrees. That will not be sustainable for the Sahel.
Is there a concern that the Niger River will deplete even more? What are the main concerns right now?
The main concern about the Niger River is that the river is shrinking. That's why, related to this shrinking of the river, all the NBS and Niger Basin Authority is trying really to develop some strategy, which even though they are not good, they have developed to develop some regional strategies. For example, building the Fomi Dam in Guinea, the Tausa Dam in Mali, and the Kandadi Dam in Niger. All these are big infrastructure from the side of NBA. They think that these are the best solution really to face COPE for the current bad situation of the Niger River.
That was Baka Kone, Mali Country Director and Niger River Expert for Wetlands International. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Bamako. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Marco Woma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with handball. Hosts Egypt play Angola as defending champions Algeria tackle Tunisia at the Africa Men's Handball Championship semifinals in Cairo today, Friday. In classification matches, the Republic of Congo face Morocco as the Democratic Republic of Congo play Cameroon. Nigeria engage Libya as Kenya play Gabon. Staying in Cairo, Gabon will host the 2018 Africa Men's Handball Championship, while Tunisia is venue for the 2020 edition of the biannual event, which will be a qualifier for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, the Africa Handball Confederation disclosed on Thursday. The current championship in Cairo is a qualifier for the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. In cricket, Zimbabwe play Fiji in Chittagong in Group C action as Namibia encounter Scotland in Cox Bazar in a Group A tie at the ICC Under-19 Cricket World Cup in Bangladesh today, Friday. On Sunday, Zimbabwe take on England as South Africa and Namibia face off. Turning to football, hosts Rwanda play the Democratic Republic of Congo in the Orange African Nations Championship quarterfinals at the Amahoro National Stadium in the capital Kigali tomorrow, Saturday. Then Cameroon engage Ivory Coast at the Huye Stadium in Butare, some 140 kilometers south of Kigali. On Sunday, Tunisia encounter Mali at the Nyamirambo Stadium in Kigali before Zambia face Guinea at the Umganda Stadium in Gishenyi, some 160 kilometers northwest of Kigali. In rugby, South Africa plays Scotland as Kenya tackle Canada at the start of their campaign in the IRB 7 Series tournament in Wellington, New Zealand tomorrow, Saturday. South Africa will also play Russia and New Zealand in Group A preliminaries, while Kenya will face Portugal and Australia in Group D fixtures. At the start of their third leg in the nine-leg series, South Africa are second with 35 points, while Kenya is ninth with 20 points among 17 countries. Finally, in boxing, Zambian Catherine Piri enters the ring to face Mexican Yasmin Rivas in a World Boxing Council women's bantamweight title fight tomorrow, Saturday. The showdown takes place in Tijuana, some 2,900 kilometers northwest of Mexico's capital, Mexico City. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that's it for this Friday, January 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte here to remind you that February is Black History Month in the United States. And starting Monday, February 1st, we will begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African American and African individuals and events. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. please send your answers to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, select the number 25 to leave us your answer. Get up.